It would be accurate to state in summary that the priestly material in Numbers 1 to 20, as in Numbers as a whole, represent, by and large, the further development of priestly law and historiography well into the post-exilic period. Such development was not merely a matter of redactional editorial activity, but also involved new writings by the post-exilic priesthood in Jerusalem and their associates. To the best of my pretty wide study of this when I was in Rome last, that's a very good statement of the situation. There'll be plenty to disagree with it, but I think it's the best scholarly stuff I can offer you. So what that means is, we've already done and seen the books of the Torah. It's the same with the books of the prophets, if you did Isaiah with me. Okay, you've got the original oracles in the prophets and the writings, but they wanted to find God's will in them for some reason, because they were, say, take the prophets, Isaiah, or Jeremiah for that matter. Isaiah at the collapse of the northern kingdom and Jeremiah at the collapse of Jerusalem. It's because they were right against most of the advice of the other people around that people thought, hey, they've got something to say. This really was from God, because Jerusalem was destroyed. Jeremiah was right, though everybody else is saying it couldn't happen. It could only happen if... because God is the God of Jerusalem. He's not going to allow a foreign God to come and beat his people. So it was an unthinkable thing. Jeremiah said, no, it's going to happen, and for these reasons. And he proved right. So then people go back and pore over the text. And then they don't only just pore over it and preserve the words as remembered that he said, but they also update them and make them relevant and see, well, in that case, what Jeremiah would say today were he still alive is, you know? And so they have scenes in which Jeremiah appears and says things, because he really was saying it, you know, like we might in a homily say, Jesus said, and we'll use words that you know are right, but they're not verbal things that he actually quoted as saying, you know. Jesus said, we've got to love each other. If I said that in a homily, no one would object. But you can't find a text where Jesus said, we've got to love each other. But you know that's the point of the... So that's happening all the way through. It's happening here in the book of Numbers. But by this time, something's happened. The text of Exodus, they've come to a point where the text is becoming fixed. They've done a lot of work on it. So instead of reshaping it after the exile, in this latter part of after, they write another book, to get it? To complement it and update it. And so the suggestion, the statement that Baruch Levine is making, and I'm agreeing with, is that the book of Numbers, you're finding, is later material added in by the priestly school to update the Torah for what was actually happening in post-exilic temple and in post-exilic Jerusalem. But it's all said to be Moses, just as all the Psalms are David, and all the wisdom literature is Solomon. You know, it's under the banner or the name of Moses, because it's trying to understand the essence of what was revealed to him. So you don't have to be thinking Moses actually wrote it. In fact, that's balmy, really. But you are thinking, no, this is reflecting to a new generation of people what Moses was saying from God. I hope you're comfortable with that, because I can't put it any better for you. So there are additions here to the law in post-exilic period. That's what we're reading. As is often the case in Exodus and Deuteronomy, the legislation is presented through story. They're great storytellers, as most sensible people are. And I'll include Jesus there. Don't want to underestimate him. But he's told stories because you don't have to be told. The prodigal son story can't be forgotten. But the theory about God's forgiveness can be a bit theoretical. But who can forget the story of the prodigal son? Nobody. Stories communicate truth to the right and left brain, and to the simple and the learned beautifully, and to children and so on. So they're doing it through story, and we're going to see some of them today. The narrative material which tells the story of various happenings on the journey of the Israelites from Mount Sinai to the plains of Moab east of the Jordan is drawn from older sources, edited by the priest authors, and we're going to see that. The book of Exodus brought them from Egypt to Mount Sinai, didn't it? And then the book of Leviticus is tucked in there, much later, of course, and that doesn't happen on the mountain, but it happens in the tabernacle at the foot of the mountain before they leave. So that's tucked in there. The book of Numbers takes us from Mount Sinai, I'll show you the map, to on the edge of going to the Promised Land. So it's filling in that big long gap. The first section is about Yahweh's fidelity. This is just background. During the wilderness period, the faithfulness of Yahweh during the period of the 40 years wandering from Mount Sinai to the Promised Land. It's a beautiful theme, and you'll find it in our texts. Here's one. This is from Amos chapter 2, verse 10. So quite an ancient 8th century, well before the book of Numbers. Here you've got already in the story of this. I brought you up out of the land of Egypt, and I led you 40 years in the wilderness. The book of Jeremiah that I was speaking about a moment ago. Thus says Yahweh. And when this was written, I'm not sure, during the exile, I suggest. Thus says Yahweh, the people who survived the sword found grace in the wilderness. When Israel sought for rest, Yahweh appeared to him from far away. I have loved you with an everlasting love. Therefore, I have continued my faithfulness to you. So they remembered this period of their ancestors journeying in the desert as a time of fidelity from God to them. And so they create stories that tell you about God's fidelity. And I'll just read to you the text from Deuteronomy, chapter 32, verse 10 to 14. He sustained him in a desert land. He is Yahweh. Him is Israel. He sustained him in a desert land, in a howling wilderness waste. He shielded him, cared for him, guarded him as the apple of his eye. As an eagle stirs up its nest and hovers over its young, as it spreads its wings, takes them up and bears them aloft on its pinions, the Lord guided him. No foreign god was with him. He set him atop the heights of the land and fed him with produce of the field. He nursed him with honey from the crags, with oil from the flinty rock, curds from the herd and milk from the flock, with fat of lambs and rams, Bashan bulls and goats, together with the choicest wheat. You drank fine wine from the blood of grapes. Beautiful poetry, I guess, simple poetry, about God's care for his people in that wilderness journey, which is the topic of the book of Numbers. However, another theme that we find right through what we're going to start studying shortly is the infidelity of the people to God. God's fidelity to them, yes, and this is all of our journeys. It's meant to be a story of every man and every woman's journey to the Promised Land. So this applies to my life and your life in different ways. Here we have from the Hosea, again, an 8th century prophet in the Northern Kingdom. So we're not suggesting the book of Numbers just made it all up from nowhere. They've got stories coming right down. This is four or five centuries earlier. Hosea is aware of these because that's how it is. Like grapes in the wilderness, I found Israel. Like the first fruit of a fig tree in its first season, I saw your ancestors. But they came to Baal Peor, and we'll study that, not today, but soon, and consecrated themselves to a thing of shame, and they became detestable like the thing they loved. they're worshipping false gods and getting caught up. Psalm 78, I will read for you too, the first eight verses about the journey in the wilderness. This is just background, obviously. Give ear, O my people, to my teaching. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth, says the psalmist as he plucks the psalm. Psalm means a harp, so you've got to hear it with a harp. If any of you play the harp, you've got to volunteer in your parish to do the responsorial psalm. We shouldn't be reading it. We always do read it in our church texts. It's just too hard to get the choirs ready, and they understand that. So we're always reading it, but you shouldn't be reading it. You should read the first reading and then relax and listen to a harp and listen to the beautiful music of the psalm, reflecting on the first reading. That's what it's for. When it becomes another reading, you get a second reading. Then you get another reading from St. Paul. Then you get the gospel. And then the priest turns around to give you the most beautiful homily you'll ever hear, and everyone's already phased out. They're reading the compact or the bulletin or the Catholic Weekly, God help us. Anyhow, back to the psalm. Give ear, O my people, to my teaching. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. I will open my mouth in a parable. I'll utter dark sayings from of old, things that we've heard and known that our ancestors told us. We will not hide them from their children. We will tell to the coming generation the glorious deeds of the Lord and his might and the wonders that he has done. He established a decree in Jacob. He appointed a law, a Torah, in Israel, which he commanded our ancestors to teach to their children, that the next generation might know them, the children yet unborn, and rise up and tell them to their children, so that they should set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments. And this is why I'm reading this, they should not be like their ancestors, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation whose heart was not steadfast, whose spirit was not faithful to God. So there's the reputation of these. They were probably as good as everybody else, but when they tell the story of the journey, they're telling the story of your journey, my journey, our journey, and they see the beauty of God, but they see our not being so beautiful in the middle of that journey. And that's what we'll see today and next week. Yet, Numbers 1 to 10, which is our topic for today, plus another couple of chapters, highlight the people's exact obedience right through the first 10 chapters. It's not such fascinating reading at all, but when you go through, they always do God's will, because they're still on the bottom of Mount Sinai. Eh? They haven't left yet. Perfectly obedient. Marvellous. It's like novices, really. You just can't go wrong. But like a honeymoon for you people. Everything's going marvellously, I hope. Well, let's read from Hosea again. I will allure her, hers the people, and I'll bring her into the wilderness, and I'll speak tenderly to her. There she shall respond as in the days of her youth, as at a time when she came out of the land of Egypt. So here's in the late 7th, 8th century, here you've got the prophet saying God's going to take us into the wilderness again, like he took us into the wilderness way back there, and it was a lovely time of first love in the desert. True, but not totally true. There's other aspects, you see. But it wasn't all bad. It was beautiful too, as Hosea remembers. And here's Jeremiah. Thus says Yahweh, I remember the devotion of your youth. So here we've got the time of the destruction of Jerusalem. I remember the devotion of your youth, your love as a bride, how you followed me in the wilderness in a land not sown. Israel was holy to Yahweh, the first fruits of his harvest. Very positive view, isn't it, of the desert time. Today we're going to see some unpositive views, and that's life. It's not all perfect. The third section of introduction is there's a lot of instruction in this book of Numbers about sacrifices and what you've got to sacrifice, what you've got to do. We're not going to go into it in great detail. And there's a lot in the book of Leviticus. It's full of it. But just look at this. Amos, I'm going back to the oldest of the written prophets now, 8th century. Amos says, did you bring to me sacrifices and offerings the 40 years in the wilderness, O house of Israel? And the implications, Dorothy, fits in with your statement. The obvious answer he's expecting is no. But if you read these books, you'd think they were full of it. No. What didn't happen then? It happened later, in other words. But they talk about it as happening then. So we're not dealing with factual history. We're dealing with religious truth communicated to people to stir them to fidelity and to commitment to God. Here's Jeremiah, written 100 years after Amos. In the day that I brought your ancestors out of the land of Egypt, I did not speak to them or command them concerning burnt offerings and sacrifices. Holy smoke. All the fundamentalists among you should be arguing with that, because the book of Leviticus is full of it. And here's Jeremiah saying what is obviously true. There was nothing said then, so why are you bothering with all this and not getting on with what really matters? Are you okay with all this? Do you see, all I'm trying to alert you to is it's complicated, but there's truth coming through all this stuff, and you've got to just step back from treating it all as factual and keep remembering the truth in story, though not factual, is profound and obviously very important. The authors of the book of Numbers, so come closer to our text now, believed that Yahweh revealed himself to their ancestors on Mount Sinai. These are the priestly authors, post-exilic, so 5th century, 4th century, 3rd century, it's still developing. He revealed himself to their ancestors on Mount Sinai, and that he wanted to be with them as they journeyed from Sinai to the Promised Land, just as he wants to be with you as you journey from your Egypt and Sinai to the Promised Land, and me too. They used this journey as a vehicle. These are my words, but I think they're good. I think this says it as accurately as I'm able to. They used this journey as a vehicle to reflect on the nature of their God, on God's will for Israel, and on what it means to put one's trust in Yahweh and to obey Yahweh's will. That's what they're trying to convey. They also picked up that element of the tradition which focused on Israel's infidelity. That's the bit we've seen a lot of it, but they're going to pick on that aspect. And they used it as an object lesson to their contemporaries not to be unfaithful. They wanted to ensure that the mistakes of the past, mistakes which had led to the tragedy of the destruction of Jerusalem and the ensuing exile, were not repeated, for their very identity as a people depended on their faithfulness to their covenant with God. You with me? That's what they wanted to do. So they're painting this picture to say, look, that's what happened back then. Brackets, that's why Jerusalem was destroyed, that's why we were put into exile, because so let's be faithful, let's do it, let's do God's will. That's their aim in writing their material. So we start, and I'm going to do 10 chapters in probably 15 or 20 minutes and then give you a break, because Aileen thinks I've got to hurry through this, which is correct. So, Numbers 1 to 10. And if you've read it ahead, you'll see why I'm not taking a lot of time over it. They're preparing to depart. That's where we are now. Right. There are certain matters that they deal with that are about holiness. And you don't need what I've said there, but you might as well get the whole lot. There are two words that frequently appear in the Hebrew for holy. One of the, oh, I can't do that with this, can I? One of them, you see the Hebrew? Kadosh, with the that bit in there, kadosh. The people are often called holy, but if you notice, there's a consonant missing. It's still kadosh, it's a long O, but it hasn't got the vav in it. So that's right through. In other words, yes, we are meant to be holy, but it's another way of saying that the holiness of God is unique and you can't use the same word for anything else. The rest is derivative, and because God is present. So let's have a look at some of these matters concerning holiness. Numbers 1 to 4 talks about care of the tabernacle, and it highlights the holiness of God. The tabernacle, inside the tabernacle, which is a big yard, there's the tent, as described in this book of Numbers, and the tent is a symbol of Yahweh's presence guiding his people and journeying with them, promising to be with them all the way to the promised land. That's why in our churches too we have our tabernacle called from this, the presence of Jesus in the community. I am with you always to the end of time. Then it talks about the roles of the Levites and the priests and the various tribes. And this is clearly late, because the distinction between priests and Levites, they were arguing forever. Priests now don't argue, but they did then. They arguing forever which group is the real priest. Because, see, once they had priests in all the little sanctuaries all through Israel. Then the northern kingdom collapsed. So what do all the priests do? That's their only job. They were, like Canberra's now, we've got so many priests, we don't know what to do with them. 10 in every parish, have you noticed? So they had so many priests, they ended up some, you know, who's going to be in charge and who's not in charge? Not very, very flattering. And eventually you end up with the Aaronite priests, and the other priests are Levites, like sacristans and flower arranging and, no, whatever else. No, I'm not knocking all that. That's lovely. Numbers chapter, we've done the first four chapters. That's it. Because I don't want to tell you anything. If you read it yourself. Numbers 5, 1 to 4, talks about the removal holiness. So you can't have anything that's not holy near God. So they've got to remove. This is significant and relevant to the New Testament as well. You have to remove from the camp anything that contaminates the holy. Now, there's a couple of things that emerge in these verses. You read them yourself. There's something that's in the Greek Old Testament translate this word lepra, the origin of our word lepa. So when you read your English translations, it will generally talk about lepers. But you might think Hansen's disease, that we know as lepers, didn't exist in the ancient world, the Middle East. The suggestion is it probably first appeared in this part of the world when the soldiers came back from India under Alexander the Great. So 300 BC was the first time it was introduced from another part of the world where it did exist. So we're not talking about leprosy. This is the translation of Levine, and I follow it. It's a scaly skin disease, and when you look at all the way it's described in the book of Leviticus and here now in the book of Numbers, when you see its description, no modern doctor can work out exactly what it is, because they didn't have the diagnostic stuff very clearly. It could be a bit of this, but the effect of it was that the skin increasingly became white and scaly. And apparently the reason why it was taboo was because it reminded people of death. It had a link with death, the skin getting quite whatever, and there was a fear attached to it, and it could contaminate others and that kind of thing. So that's one reason for people with this scaly, I'm calling it a scaly skin disease, because it could be healed, you see, which leprosy can't. You can stop leprosy getting worse, but if you've lost your hand because of leprosy, you're not going to get it back. It doesn't regenerate. So it's because it's a nerve complaint, isn't it? So, and you just rub your hand, you don't know what you're doing, and you put your hand in the fire and you don't feel it until it burns and all that kind of thing. So leave leprosy off. We're not talking about that. We're talking about some, and it can change. And they've got all little rituals for when it, if it, you see, oh, it has got better, you can come back in. So we're not. So that existed. And in the New Testament, by the way, remember the leper that came up to Jesus? He's not a leper, but he's got this scaly skin complaint. And so the second thing that they had to make sure was outside the camp was genital discharge of any kind, male or female. And the reason for that is, particularly in the male, it's about life. It's life being lost. And life was sacred. And they understood that in the semen, the male semen was actually, I've said this to you before, I know, but it's worth remembering, they thought the male semen was actually a human being in miniature. They didn't know about the female contribution to the conception of. So it was the male was the one who gave life, and the female welcomed it and nurtured it and brought it into the world and all of those beautiful things that women do so well. But they didn't contribute to the life. That's why all the old genealogies are all male, because they're about handing on life. The women didn't hand on life. They did, but they didn't know they did. So genital discharge was seen as life wasting. And so that also was something had to be removed from the camp. How they did it, God knows, but anyhow, that's the rule. Ancient Israel shared with its contemporaries the conviction that there are forces at work threatening the holy. Some cultures have still got this pretty, we're so secular, we wouldn't think like this, I don't think. And that's not good either. But there are cultures that are pretty aware of these demonic things and all that negativity coming in and affecting the holy. And so their prosperity, their very existence as a nation, depended on God's presence among them, blessing them and protecting them. And if they allowed certain things into the camp, then God might leave. And if God left, we're unprotected, unblessed, you know, because God can't stay where there's sin and corruption and death engendering forces. Some of it's magic, you can see that, can't you? But God can't be there, so God would have to say, well, I have to leave. So they didn't want God to leave, so therefore you must make sure everything's pure. It's a concept that takes a bit of work on, but I think you can probably follow the logic of it. The most serious threat to Yahweh's presence is deliberate sin, often translated transgression, and I've got the Hebrew word there in English, pesha. Consciously and deliberately acting against God's declared will, breaking the covenant, would make God abandon us. So we've got to do something about it. We've got to stop it. We've got to kill people who are going to repent. Get rid of them. Get them outside the camp and kill them, and so that only the pure are here, otherwise God might go. To a lesser degree, even inadvertent sin, which has got another name, hata'at, had to be atoned for, and contact with anything that belonged to the sphere of death had to be carefully managed. Leviticus is full of this, Numbers has a little bit of it. And they've got all what you can eat and what you can't eat, and why you couldn't eat certain food was because it was related to death or murky or the whatever it was. Or in the case of pigs, it was because pigs were being used by the Canaanites in their sacrificial things. So they had to stop pigs being eaten because they would entice them into some kind of pagan religious ritual. Now, that's not that interesting for us, I guess, but there it is. Numbers chapter 5, verses 5 to 10, talks about making restitution, ethical demands of being holy, and they're fair enough, read them yourself. Numbers 5, 11 to 31, a woman suspected of adultery but claiming to be innocent is put under a curse of miscarriage or sterility if she's in fact guilty. So it's just and she'd be so frightened to death she might end up being sterile. just out of fear, like pointing the bone, you know, in some of these cultures. It creates the fear. And so then, so it's pretty primitive. Numbers 6, 1 to 21 is about the Nazarites, the consecration of the Nazarites and rules governing their behaviour. These were like a little religious order. That might be a good parallel to have. If you were a Nazarite, you weren't allowed to have intoxicating drink. So no Catholics were Nazarites. You weren't allowed to cut your hair, so all teenagers were okay. No contact with a corpse. Couldn't contact a corpse. Even family members, if you were a Nazarite, had this special vow, then even if your mother died, you couldn't go to the funeral or be anywhere near her because you had to keep away from all of that. And they had special sacrifices when the vow expires. And if you're interested in that, you know where to read it. This is all getting ready for the journey. Here's a text you all know from chapter 6, verse 22 to 27. Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, thus you shall bless the Israelites. You shall say to them, Yahweh bless you and keep you. Yahweh make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. Yahweh lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace." It's one of the possible blessings. In our parish, we have that as a kind of parish song that we sing whenever anyone gets First Communion or any sacrament or marriage or 50 years or whatever. We hold our hands out and give them all the blessing. That's a nice practice. "So they put my name on the Israelites and I will bless them." So that's where that beautiful blessing, priestly blessing, comes from. There are further matters concerning the tabernacle in chapter 7. There are offerings by the various tribal leaders. There's the laws about the lampstand and the lamps that they're going to have to take with them on their journey. Dedication of the Levites, celebration of the Passover by those who are ritually clean on the appointed night. This is all in chapter 9. And note the ease with which the various writers were able to attribute the changes in legislation to Yahweh. They trusted that Yahweh, the name they gave their God, was actively present among them in the post-exilic world, eh? And that the changes they were making, just as we might think that the changes we're making in the liturgy of the Mass somehow are providential or guided by the Spirit of God. They aren't always, clearly, but some of them would be. So we've got a general, I would think, a humble attitude to think, oh, well, the Spirit of God is guiding the Church, and so if changes are made of our ritual, well, then we don't start off by being rebellious. We start off by being humble and accepting it, and if it doesn't work, we find ways around it. Is it the way you work? You kind of, but in general, you're not rebellious about it, because you believe somehow the Spirit of God is present, guiding the Church. So the Spirit might also be guiding your refusal to do it. So there's all that subtle stuff that needs to be done. So they trusted Yahweh was actively present among them, and that the changes were consistent with the essence of the revelation that formed them into a people, and to which they were attempting to be faithful in whatever changes they deemed were inspired by the living God. And they are making later changes, but they're putting them right back in Sinai at the foot of the hill in the tabernacle from Moses, from God through Moses. There's an introductory statement that they are to move camp, this is beautiful, only in obedience to Yahweh. And I'll read that for you. This is chapter 9, verse 15 to 17. "On the day the tabernacle was set up, the cloud covered the tabernacle." So the cloud is the mystery of God's presence. "The tent of the covenant. And from evening until morning it was over the tabernacle, having the appearance of fire during the night." You know, cloud by day, fire by night. Here we are again. So it's glowing. "It was always so. The cloud covered the tabernacle by day and appearance of fire by night. And whenever the cloud lifted from above the tent," this is the instruction, "the Israelites would set out," because God is telling them, it's time to go. So we collect everything, pull it together, get the cattle going, and move. And in the place where the cloud settled down, if the cloud came... Well, this is not factual. This is a beautiful story, though. The cloud settled again, we stop. Because God is showing us where to set up camp. So it's God's presence among them, guiding them, and it's not a bad idea for all of us, is it? To want to do what God wants. And here it's expressed quite simply and dramatically and beautifully in the traditional formula of the cloud and the fire. Numbers chapter 10, they depart from Mount Sinai. This is the last page before we take a break, and then we'll get into more the next two chapters at a little bit more depth. So we're getting ready for the departure. The tabernacle was completed and consecrated in the first month of the second year on the first day of the month. Well, you'd think you were right in touch with history there, wouldn't you? It's all pretty clear. Well, of course it's clear. And if you can trace that back to Exodus 40:17, it's a year after the Israelites left Egypt. And you'll see that in Exodus chapter 12, verse 18. So they're writing it in a consistent, dramatic way. They'd arrived at Sinai on the third new moon after leaving Egypt. That's in Exodus chapter 19, verse 1. And now, 1 month and 20 days after the consecration of the tabernacle, brackets, that was the time that covered from Leviticus 1:1 to Numbers 9:23. All that material had to fit in somewhere, because it takes time to write it all down and get it all organised. So 1 month and 20 days, that's when the book of Leviticus was written by Moses, get me? And that's when the first nine chapters happened. So that's all fitted in there nicely in this schematic way of doing it. And they set out now to begin their journey. And you're going to set out in a moment to have a cup of tea.